Welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. That music is a composition by my guest who's going to be in here for this entire first hour of the show, talking about creativity, because he is my model for creativity. He has been called, I think, by the Tribune, not by me, but by the Tribune, a Renaissance man. He's had a remarkable, I think, ongoing career being creative. What is that song, Grant Robin? Welcome to the show, and when did you write it?
Thank you. I wrote it about a year ago.
What is it for? You just wrote it to play on my show?
I wrote it in conjunction with a screenplay of the same name, Strangers in Paris.
Okay, what's that about?
2 hours.
He's also a stand-up comic, ladies and gentlemen.
Grant, you forgot really, I was a second city.
You have. You're right. You weren't, but that's improv.
Okay.
You have had, you really have, and I've kind of followed it from afar. I did write about you once many, many years ago, but I followed it from afar. You have had as interesting a career as almost anybody I know.
Okay.
Did your career start in advertising?
No.
Where did it start?
In college.
When you were sparked by what?
I'd always wanted to perform.
Where are you from?
I'm from Chicago.
Where?
Give
me a high school.
I'll give you two.
You
two Lehigh and Sen High.
You went to both?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, just a reminder, I'm not going to discuss this on the air, but I know somebody who knows you from those early days.
What early days? I didn't go to either of those schools.
No, you didn't. But
Saul Bellow went to Tooley High School. You know that, right?
Who did?
Saul Bellow. And my mother went to Sen, but that's beside the point.
Okay.
So you went to high school, and you're in college, your creativity was sparked?
Yes, pretty much.
By what?
Well, I'll backdate it.
Go back as long as you want.
In high school, I used to do impressions for friends.
Yeah.
And make cracks, and people would laugh at it, but I was very shy. Actually, I'm embarrassed to say a good friend of mine, I would make something that he thought was funny, he'd crack up, and then he'd repeat it. It was like having a dummy.
Who were you doing impressions of, like Jimmy Cagney? Or
no, I was doing...
What was your repertoire?
My repertoire was dating me right off, aren't you?
Go ahead. So what?
Ed Sullivan, of course.
Yeah, sure.
Alfred Hitchcock. I'm forgetting. It's been a long time.
No Jimmy Cagney?
I didn't do Cagney. Bela Lugosi.
Those are standard ones. Those are Boris Karloff.
Yeah.
So in high school, you're noted for your mimicry and your ability to ape famous people.
Yes.
That, unless you're really, really good at it, doesn't really translate into some kind of career.
Unless you're Frank Gorshin and you're extraordinary.
meaning you're really, really good at it.
Right.
That wasn't going to be your career.
I didn't think so. My friends used to tease me because we owned a family owned a restaurant.
Which one?
It's called Robin's Restaurant.
Where?
On the corner of Wacker and Adams, where Sears was.
Oh, wow. Sure.
You probably were there at some point. I'm guessing your dad might have been there.
Yeah, I certainly know the name.
You could have been named after that restaurant instead of Ricardo's.
That's true.
You could have been Robin Kogan.
Did they serve drinks at Robin's?
No.
My mother would not have named me Robin Kogan.
But great corned beef.
I'll tell you that. Obviously, maybe not obviously, but your parents want you to get in the restaurant business?
Yeah, my father and my grandfather. But my mother had the musical background.
Of what sort?
She was a fabulous musician with piano, had her own radio show with her sister.
What station? Not GM.
I don't remember.
Okay. That's still
I don't know
good.
If I ever was told. And she was asked to tour with some big band, but she was like 13. Her parents wouldn't let her go. So.
Good for them, your grandparents. So you go to college.
Yeah.
And what happens?
I tried my hand at a few different things, directing shows.
What college?
University of Wisconsin.
Madison?
Yeah.
Nice town. With a legendary sort of theater department for many, many years, right? Stuart Gordon, who founded the Organic Theaters,
right.
An old Madison kid, a little after you, not much.
After me.
Not much.
Yeah.
But did you get, what did you get up? You got the theater bug up there?
I got the theater bug, but I also wanted, I could sing, and I could do the impressions. So an opportunity came along, a thing called humorology, which was all the fraternities and sororities would have these big sketches. They'd write music for it, and they'd build sets and everything. Huh. They were the focus. But in between that, they had to have on tracks so they could change the scenery.
Right, right.
So you could be a juggler, you could be a comedian, whatever. So I figured...
Well, like vaudeville.
It kind of was. It's a good comparison. So I thought, I don't know if I'd have the nerve to do this today, but I try my hand. So I put together a little bit, and I did some impressions, and then I finished singing What Kind of Fool Am I?
Wow. You're the shy kid.
Right? Well, you know, a lot of performers are.
That's true. That's true. And did you major in theater up there?
I did.
With the notion of doing what, Grant Robin?
Performing.
Performing, not
I didn't direct. Want to be behind the scenes.
Did you want to write?
I was staying up late night. My parents got me a guitar. I started writing songs then. And I was writing comedy sketches.
Interesting. Interesting. This is in the 60s, roughly. Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah,
I think you're right.
You think so.
But what happened from the humorology thing was, this will sound like bragging, but...
Go ahead.
I got all the headlines.
Oh, interesting.
So I had my moment. I wasn't a football player.
This play is terrible, but the man coming in doing impressions of Ed Sullivan is fantastic. We're going to spend this whole hour with Grant Robin talking about one of his books, about some upcoming films, about one of his plays, about his time at Second City, about his time in the ad game, because I want to explore with him what makes a creative human. First, I'll tell you this. Make Sundays your official night to tour the city. Watch Chicago's Best at 10 p.m. Then stick around for the latest in shopping, entertainment, and events on See Chicago at 10:30 on WGN-TV. We'll be back in a couple minutes. This is more music composed by my guest this hour, Grant Robin, a creative soul who is just so far in his life as we've captured it on the air. He is doing impressions of Ed Sullivan, and he's at college, and people think he's talented. You're up at University of Wisconsin in Madison. Your parents are behind this. They run Robin's Restaurant in Chicago, but they're okay with you exploring your creative side at the university?
Especially my mother.
Yeah, yeah.
Because of that's
her
where it all came from.
Sure, sure.
My dad, to this day, I don't know 100% what he felt, but He went along with it.
He was supportive to a point. Yeah, I get it.
But he was a very sweet man, and he wanted me to do what I did.
So you get out of the university with a theater degree?
Yeah.
And so then what? Then you come back to Chicago?
Very quickly after, I got into Second City.
Really? Who were some in what aspect of Second City?
As an actor.
Who were some of your colleagues at the time?
David Steinberg.
Wow.
We're going way back.
Yeah, and I know, but I know...
James Polk was in office.
Yeah, but I know the history of Second City pretty well.
Omar Shapley, who's from the original group.
Yeah, yeah. How did you get in? I mean, obviously, you auditioned for Bernie Sollins then?
I auditioned. Bernie might have been there. This was when Sheldon Patinkin, the great Sheldon Patinkin.
The
first group that he directed.
Wow.
Paul Sills.
Yeah.
Handed over the reins to him.
Wow. You couldn't have known at the time what a big deal it was to get into Second City. You could only know it's a nice creative atmosphere and you may be up on stage and, you know, right?
No, I actually kind of did because my parents took me to Compass Players.
Did they really, down at the University of Chicago?
Yeah.
Wow. So you had arrived then, right? or you thought you did?
I didn't assume that. I was just thrilled to, you know, be asked to do it.
What? How long were you with Second City?
A little under a year.
What was that experience like for you?
It was exciting. In those days, it wasn't a corporate venture now, and they had all these companies.
Sure.
We were it. We were the touring company. We went to New York and did some shows.
Were you still in the Chinese Laundry on Wells, or had you moved to the current home on Wells near North?
We were where Hemingway House is.
Yeah, right. Chinese, above the Chinese Laundry. Yeah. Sure. Sure, you had. Wow. And so you met Steinberg, and you did the classic Second City improv scene, and you put on shows, and you obviously got reviewed by people who were reviewing for the paper.
Sam Lesner.
Good old Sam Lesner at the Daily News.
Gave me a beautiful review.
I know, Sam. I worked with Sam.
I'm sure you did.
I worked with Sam. Why only a year, then?
How do you mean that?
Why were you there for only a year?
Well, Second City, you either leave... You become famous, you go on to something else. And I, at night, I'd come home from doing a show, I'd start writing songs. And then I had to decide, am I going to go with the music, am I going to try and do comedy? And the music went over.
Wow. And did you go and tell Sheldon I'm leaving? You obviously had.
Yeah.
And that wasn't a tough break, and you thought... Had any of your music been performed anywhere at that time?
I have a strange history with that, which you're going to...
Go ahead.
Which is unique for me. Unique for the world, in a sense. I started with very little material. And I was very protective of it, and I wasn't... I wrote it so that I could do kind of what Oscar Brown did.
Sure.
Be a singer, actor. I mean, I have a good voice.
Yeah.
Or I also was inspired by people like Charles Aznavour, Jacques Brel, Chansonniers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I felt it was like having your own art gallery. You could write about whatever you wanted.
That's well put.
And then perform it. And that idea was thrilling to me.
All right. Where did you do that? Where did you try to do that?
I did that at various places around Chicago, all of which you're going to know. I did it at the London House.
I did
it at Mother Blues.
Sure, Mother Blues on Wells Street. And how'd that go? How did you bill yourself? Would you name the show? Would it be like...
No, it'd just be my name.
With Grant Robin or something?
Yeah, just your name.
And how'd that go?
It went okay. I found that I had a problem because my music didn't fit into a category. And that I saw that even more evident because I went to New York later on.
Yeah, yeah.
I did Punchinello's East. I was the opening act with Ronnie Graham.
Good Lord.
You remember Ronnie Graham?
Yes, I do. I'm old. I remember everybody now. Ronnie Graham was a big talent. And you played these Chicago clubs and then made that transition to New York?
Yeah, but first I did a special for PBS.
What was it?
Grant Robin in concert.
For national PBS or for WTTW?
It was for WTTW, but it was syndicated.
Wow.
I went to a bunch of cities, including Samoa.
That's not a city.
I'm a very big hit in Samoa. I get off that plane.
And you're mobbed.
People are screaming.
And you're mobbed.
Yeah.
So did you think, though, Grant, I mean, did you think at this time, well, I'm really on my way. I'm in showbiz, man.
Yeah, but you never take it for granted because you're going from one thing to the next.
Yeah.
I never assumed that this was a done deal.
What was New York like then?
It was wild because I lived in the Village, and there were all the stars from the 60s, both in music and in comedy, were there.
Nichols and May, Bob Dylan.
Mort
Saul, Lenny Bruce.
Yeah, all those guys.
Yeah.
And
well, it was a very competitive scene, too.
It was. And Richard Pryor, Hendrix. And you'd see these people between their going out of town on tours.
Yeah, yeah.
So I played the Bitter End, and I played some other clubs. But my music didn't fit in.
It was uncategorizable, right?
That's pretty much what it was. I wasn't totally folk, but I did elements of that.
You weren't blues.
Yeah, I auditioned at the Vanguard, the Village Vanguard, and all these places, but I wasn't
jazz enough.
And I wasn't going to start writing music to fit a place.
Good for you. Good for you. You wanted to follow your own creative.
Yeah,
art,
I did.
Right?
And I turned down Barry Manilow. Was we were managed by the same guy, and he was a friend of mine. He wasn't. He worked in the mailroom at NBC.
Yeah, right.
And he actually only sang in partnership with a girl that he played piano with.
Mm.
So it was difficult. I mean, I couldn't find a hold, and I was offered things. Because of my Second City background, I was offered some possible TV things and also some musicals like Fiddler.
Wow.
But that's not what I wanted to do.
Wow, that is. So you left New York and came back here.
Yeah, and I got two offers. I'm somewhat shy to mention this because...
Why? It was a long time ago.
Well, people won't understand my way of thinking. I got offered a record deal from RCA was one, and then Columbia. Columbia wanted to buy my songs.
Okay.
I went up to a meeting with a big executive behind a huge desk. He said, we want to give your songs. And he mentioned Sinatra and Streisand. And
you said no.
I said no.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other deal was to sing pop songs.
No.
They love my voice, but
yeah.
I wanted to do both.
Yeah.
I couldn't land that deal.
So you turned your back on New York. This is fascinating. Grant Robin is here for this entire hour talking about his career. He is going to get some commercials and a news, and we'll come back and see what happens when he comes back to Chicago after telling people in New York, I don't want Sinatra singing my song. That Barbara Streisand, she's no good. That's fascinating, but you stuck to your creative guns, and that's good. A couple commercials and some news, and we'll be back after that. That is another composition by my guest for the rest of this hour, Grant Robin, who people offered to buy his songs in New York, and they wanted him to sing pop songs because he had a good voice, but he was determined to hang on to these songs and his own creation. And so you came back here. And what'd you do back here? Did you continue playing clubs and doing that?
I got another special on PBS.
Oh, another singing musical.
My music, Grant Robin in Concert Part 2.
And what did that lead to?
Some other gigs. And
then you got in the, somehow you got in the advertising game, didn't you?
I did, because I had this strange habit of wanting to eat three meals a day.
Yes. and have a place to live and some place to sleep.
So I'm an artist and a designer, and I thought, actually, the way that came about is I had been teaching at Columbia. This is how I started at Columbia. I had been working with the Tribune.
Yeah.
That's how I began doing ads for them. And apparently Columbia College called them and asked they needed somebody to teach advertising design.
Huh.
So they recommended me, so I got a call from this woman. I knew nothing about advertising. I knew I could design stuff,
sure.
And I knew I had the talent. I didn't know the terminology, anything. So when she called, she said, I'd like to meet with you. Come down. And I thought, I'd been thinking about taking a course because I really needed to know what I was doing. I was going on Oak Street and getting all these high fashion.
Yeah.
They knew more than I did. They would talk about a reverse. I had no idea. I thought they were talking about driving.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
I didn't know what they were talking about. So I thought, I'll go down and see what she has to say. I thought she wanted me to take a course. She wanted me to teach.
She was selling. Yeah, she wanted you to teach. So a bath by fire. Well, you learned on the job then, right?
Right. Yes.
You learned on the job. Did you like the advertising biz?
It wasn't the worst thing I've ever done.
Yeah.
What is
the worst thing you've ever done? How can you say something like that and not expect me to ask you?
You know, Rick, you're getting more out of me.
You a hitman?
You know more
about
me right now than my therapist does.
Yes, but I'm free. I'm free.
No one else is hearing any of this, are they?
Yeah. No. Well, there are a few people out there.
Just you and me, right?
There are a few people out there. So you do that, but the creative urge and your creativity does not wane. I mean, it continues. Let's talk about the leap to in the early 2000s. First you started writing screenplays, right?
Yes.
And did you have success with that?
I've only written a handful.
Mm-hmm. What drew you to that?
The seminars that I did at Northwestern, I produced seminars for 10 years.
Yeah.
I brought in all Hollywood people.
Well, again, it's something you're running the seminars and you're learning on the job about how to do it.
But I am.
It's a good idea.
I am.
It's a good idea.
Almost everything I've done has been learning on the job.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's part of the creative drive.
I mean,
you don't say to yourself, well, I know everything, because if you do that, then you're never going to learn anything.
I realized how little I knew about storytelling when I heard those people talk. I knew I could create a song and tell pretty easily if it was going to be effective or not. I mean, it's 3.5 minutes.
Sure.
But a screenplay, over 100 pages, how do you organize that? How do you put that together?
Very interesting. Very interesting. Then you made a leap to playwriting, did you not? Musical theater.
Well, in between that, I did a first book, another book.
What was
that? Of writings and drawings called Lifestyles.
Huh.
And I took about 15 categories, single, married, divorced, widowed, man, woman, man, woman, and I did an ink drawing for each one and a poem for each one.
Oh, neat. I didn't know you had a first book. We're going to devote certainly some time to Iron Ix, this sort of haunting book of Grant's that recently published last year, I think, and it's chilling and haunting at the same time. You do, notably, if you Google Grant Robin, and you will find a ton about Grant Robin and Gauguin, because in about 2002, you wrote, produced, and wrote the music for a notable play based on the life of Paul Gauguin.
Yes.
Why? I mean, I know that you were, I read in interviews, you were very taken with Gauguin, his work and his life.
When I was little on Sundays, my father would take me out, we would watch sports. We'd also go to the Art Institute a lot. So, unlike a lot of other young boys, some of my heroes were the artists.
Interesting.
I was aware of Gauguin and Van Gogh at a very early age. Later on, I read about his life.
Realized those two jokers were roommates for kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, that must have been a place to live.
And he had an incredible life. His work and his life, they were both controversial.
Yeah, well, sure. He abandoned his family and went to Tahiti. Yeah.
Yes, he did.
But that inspired you to write this show. And
I wrote a song called The Artist with him in mind. He never mentions him,
mm-hmm.
which is maybe my signature song from those years.
Yeah.
And from that, I got the idea, I'm going to expand this.
Interesting. And it was Chris Jones, the theater critic for the Chicago Tribune, even then, loved the music, didn't so much like the story. Hedy Weiss of the Sun-Times liked it all.
Yeah.
Did you have big ambitions for that show? Did you have the idea to take that show to New York?
Absolutely.
What happened?
9/11. I thought I had figured everything out. I timed it with an exhibition at the Art Institute, which I knew about way in advance of the public knowing about it.
Yeah.
So I timed it.
Hmm.
And I brought in a Broadway director.
You had some big stars in it. You had equity
stars. Yeah, I had a Broadway actor, a musical director from New York, who got out amid the rubble.
Ugh.
We were in the middle of rehearsals when that happened. I'm the one that had to tell them that they all lived there.
I'm so sorry. Jesus Christ.
Ugh. But we weren't going to stop. So.
Yeah. Oh. So that show never went anywhere. We got to take one more break, and we're going to come back and talk about what Grant's doing now. He's got a screenplay in the works, yes.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a play in the works, yes. You've got this book out and about, yes. Mm-hmm. That's enough. That's three things.
Not really, but it's a start.
It's a start for him. I'll tell you that the Bears are facing the Jets. Now, this is an old... I can't read this. They're not facing the Jets this weekend. I'm not going to read that then. They have faced the Jets, and they have beaten the Jets. There you go. We'll take a little commercial break, and we'll be back with Grant Robin.
Will you be there when spring arrives and brings hope to our broken dreams? Life can hold more than it seems. Will you be?
Welcome back. That is not just the music of Grant Robin. That is the voice of Grant Robin. He said he was a terrific singer, and you can hear that he is. In the few minutes we have left, I want to try to cover three different things. You have a play you have written called Gellhorn in Love and War. Some people out there might recognize that name. Who's Gellhorn?
Martha Gellhorn was considered by many to be the greatest war correspondent of the 20th century. People who know of her know her more for her marriage to Ernest Hemingway.
Yes, he cast a big shadow. Where is that play as we speak?
I'm in the process of starting, I got a lot to read.
Mm-hmm.
She wrote a lot of books. She was a novelist.
Hemingway wrote some books, and people wrote a lot of books about Hemingway.
Yes.
What about Hemingway and his wives, The Greatest Story Never Told? That's an interesting idea for a film, isn't it?
That is. That's a screenplay.
And is it finished, completed?
I've got more to do.
Okay, but you're confident that in a year or so I can have you back on this show and you can say, Rick, the movie opens next week. The play is at the Goodman Theater.
Your lips.
Yeah, no kidding. What compelled you to put together this fascinating book called Ironix, I-R-O-N-I-X?
Yeah, Ironix.
Ironix, oh, I get it. It is a chilling, I think it's chilling. It is hardly a hopeful book. It is a series of images and very few words. For instance, on one page, there is a haunting picture of a polar bear on a small piece of ice, floating ice, and it says underneath, In Memoriam. What's the seed of this book, Grant? How did this book come to be?
I thought you were going to ask me that, and I'm still trying to figure out where that came from.
Nightmare? I mean, serious. I mean, some of these images are nightmarish. I mean, it's like when you start to think about it, and you start to think about something like a tragedy that happened yesterday.
Yes.
And a tragedy that happens with astonishing frequency in this screwed-up world. It's kind of a bleak picture. Here's another one, a man walking in a wasteland. Underneath it says, war is a wound that never heals. And I can imagine in some way, this is a sad one too, a handicapped parking space underneath that says, perk for vets. I can imagine that some of this came to you in nightmares, literally.
I can't attest to that.
Right.
But I didn't have to be asleep to have these nightmares.
Yeah. What compelled you to put it in book form?
I wanted to make a statement about so many contemporary issues. I didn't want to write a book per se about it. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of those and wonderful ones
right.
at that.
Sure.
I wanted to see if I could use my artistic talent as an artist and as a writer.
And as an ad man, too, I think.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
And make strong statements that would shock and provoke. Some of them people will laugh at. Some,
sure.
they might get a tear from. And
well,
I didn't know if I could come up with enough ideas, but I did.
You did. Ironix. Here's the so-called an introduction. Ironix by Renaissance man Grant Robin is a collection of images that cast a searing and provocative eye on the world in which we live. These images raise profound questions about the path our world is on. While science and technology expand exponentially, what about the morality of mankind? And while remarkable achievements such as space exploration, nuclear energy, the internet, artificial intelligence, computers, cell phones and social media seemingly improve our lives, do they also diminish our ability to empathize, self-reflect, and ultimately survive? That's a timely piece of writing, my friend.
Thank you.
There's one. Pages are not numbered, but they each page has a large illustration and some words, and there's a sort of photo illustration of the Statue of Liberty with a huge tear coming down her eye and the word sorry underneath, and that reminds me of the famous Bill Malden editorial cartoon of the Abraham Lincoln Memorial statue in Washington, D.C., sobbing at the news of the death of assassination of John Kennedy. How can people get this book, Runt?
It's on Amazon.
It is called Ironix.
Yeah.
I-R-O-N-I-X by Grant Robin. It's a really chilling kind of book. Okay, what did you've got the play, you've got the book, you've got the screenplay. What else have you got? Now, don't tell me you're going to start a restaurant or something.
No, I passed on that years ago.
Okay.
Well, I think I got my hands full with all this. A lot of research.
Is that how you spend your days, writing and researching, basically?
And deleting emails.
Emails from who?
Everybody.
Stumble? What do you mean everybody?
I'm so popular.
These people still want you. Sell us that song. Frank Sinatra may be dead, but we want to buy your song. And you're still writing music.
Yes.
You can't perform because your hearing will not allow.
Yes.
It's a little unstable, shall we say. When you look back at your life, and it's not time to look back at your life, but when you look back at your life, are you happy with all the decisions you've made? Not all of them. Who could be happy with all of them? But with
I sometimes kick myself for some of the decisions, but I will never have to look back and say, what if?
Yeah, yeah. Well, because you've also got, you know, some of the music that Aubrey's been playing of your own composition and your own stuff is really quite good.
Thank you.
I mean, are you thinking, talk to me a little bit more about the play, because I know a little bit about Hollywood, and you know, getting a movie made is an arduous task.
Yeah.
It's not; it's really not in your hands. It's in the hands of a bunch of idiot executives, mostly. Can we get this guy to start giving a play? You have a little more control over, because there are some nice theater spaces all over Chicago. Do you have more confidence that Hemingway and his women, his wives, will see the stage before Martha sees Martha's on his?
Well, my plan is to finish, and I normally don't work on two at the same time, or even have two in the hopper at the same time. But I want to do the play. I want to do Martha Gellhorn. I'm very fascinated by her, and that might actually even be easier, as you're saying, to launch. It's a one-person show.
Wow, you need the right, you really need the right actress, though.
Yeah, that's like, exactly true.
You know, someone like Amy Morton at Steppenwolf would be pretty interesting.
Wow, that's an interesting idea.
That is an interesting thought. Now I'm the executive producer of your play.
How about Charlize Theron for Broadway? Charlize, you're listening.
Yes, Charlize Theron is one of the big fans of this show. Well, you know, I'm grateful for you coming in. I did want to explore your creative life, and it's a fascinating one.
Thank you very much.
I think you've done a ton of good work, and you keep doing really good work, and I can't wait. I would be delighted to go to opening night of that play.
You'd absolutely be my guest.
Well, no, I can pay. Grant, it's good to see you. I hope to run into you at 11 City Diner or some other great Chicago restaurant. But keep me posted on everything.
I will,
you,
absolutely.
Please? Thank you so much. Coming up, the stories that matter with Roger Badish from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. And first, a couple commercials. I'll keep playing, folks. This is a very special adventure we're having here. There's an entire band in the studio. The leader of this band, if I can call you the leader, is my old friend Sid Yiddish, who I met, I don't know, You can keep doing that. I don't care. Go ahead. This is live radio. It's good. Here's how I described him when we first met. He was doing a performance at the old El Jardín near Wrigley Field. And I said, Yiddish did a bit of singing and played the shofar, a ram's horn. He fooled around with a Ouija board. His act was at once appealing and odd. Some people scratched their heads, others laughed, and some did both. When he came up to me and said, what do you think, Rick? I said, I think you make Andy Kaufman look like Jack Benny. He described his music then. Do you remember this, Sid? How you described it then? You described it as international industrial poet, actor, throat sing, tap dancing spy.
Well, that's the way I describe myself, not the music itself. The music that I brought, that I have now, the band that I have now, the Candy Store Henchmen, it's improvisation.
And you lead this, though. And how did this group come together?
Well, in 2010, I had the opportunity to do a part of a project. It was called Project in D. So I put people together. We had about six people that came and put them together. And then we played one night at the 1901... Gallery, which was on Wolcott and Belmont.
Sure.
And that was also the show where a German Shepherd joined us for a couple of courses.
That is a band with a German Shepherd. You thrive, do you not, on improvisation?
I mean,
that is what you do.
Right.
You are, however, having a show Tuesday at the Museum of Contemporary Art. Describe for me, before we hear some of the henchmen playing, you'll introduce them all. Describe a show to me, will you?
Yeah.
If you can. Well, I know it is of the moment, and you have to see it.
Right. Well, to give you an example of what we're going to do at the MCA, this is a kind of a year-long thing that I finally got to now. We're going to play a live bingo game. A bingo card has 75 numbers on it, 75 numbers you could possibly pull out. Well, I just happen to have 75 gestures. And
is that all?
Yeah, that's all. And I've assigned the gestures to the bingo ball numbers. So let's say three, I think, is downbeat, which is two hands going down. That would be number three, just to give an example.
Yeah.
There's a lot of crazier ones, but the gestures are from everyday life that we use.
Well, it's also, I mean, it looks almost like when you're doing it here, it looks like some kind of like a third base coach or something, you know?
Yeah, that's funny. Somebody once compared me to Don Zimmer.
Don Zimmer. That would be something. But it is all, and the henchmen then improvise off your signal, or
what they do is they interpret the gestures as such. So usually that's what they do, and if they don't know what they're doing, I usually tell them, just make it look like you do.
And how often do you collaborate? You obviously don't rehearse.
I mean, actually
you can't rehearse.
Well, no, actually for the MCA show we did rehearse.
And how did that go?
Went pretty well, actually.
But you're not going to certainly play it. You can't. This is an of the moment musical and artistic experience, is it not?
Right, it is. Okay. It is totally.
Let me see what time it is. All right, why don't you introduce your collaborators?
Okay.
Look, that's a guitar. That I know. I know that's a guitar.
Well, that's not just any ordinary guitar. We'll get there. So on screwdriver electric guitar.
Oh, that's right. It's a screwdriver.
That is 13 going on 12. On drum kit, cymbal, plastic horn, that is June Sprinzer.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. Got to say it louder, man, so they can hear you.
Thank you.
There you go. But he's the problem with 13-12. He's got laryngitis, so he.
Okay, you'd be quiet. He's going to play. His guitar and screwdriver can speak for him.
And this on oscillator, this is Babs.
Hello, Babs. Are you fresh from a Halloween party, or is that your conventional eye makeup?
Conventional.
It is? Every day?
No, but it's a performance, right?
Yeah. Well, not in here. I mean, this is radio.
And And me, I'm playing the double belled trumpet, which is a bell horn stuffed into a trumpet.
How many instruments do you play? And I use the term instrument very broadly.
What would we say?
Very broadly.
200?
200.
At least?
Yeah.
But just, we're talking about found instruments, regular instruments I have in my studio at home.
Could you, four people, my four new friends, could you perform something for about 2 minutes before a commercial? Then we'll have some commercials, and then I'd like to hear from all of you about this upcoming show. Would that be okay?
Yeah. So let's do this one. And
I wish this were on TV.
Well,
what do you want me to do?
All right. So you're going to be playing with us. You're an honorary henchman. So you're going to let you play the windshield wiper blades.
I'm an expert at this. I've been playing this for years.
So this is a piece I call Where's Walgreens?
Where's Walgreens? Okay.
June, where's Walgreens?
There is no Walgreens. Walgreens is a figment of our collective imagination.
I just don't know anymore.
Walgreens, well, if you jump off the 18th floor here and you drop yourself in the river and you float down like on your belly or something, and then you jump up like Superman, and then you make a right and you walk down Clark Street, and then you hop into an Uber, and then you go all the way down for about 30 minutes down to Broadway. There's one right there by Granville. Hey, Rick, where's Walgreens? Where's Walgreens, Rick?
Walgreens is in your mind. I love that. I mean, you are all... This is... totally unrehearsed, I would like to think. Certainly my part was totally unrehearsed. And he orchestrates. He begins the process, and he will ask you questions, and you are at your... You have no improvisational leisure. You do what you want to do. Yes?
Yeah.
Is that... Yes. Have I got it?
Yeah.
Because that's what I did. We'll take a quick commercial break. Then I want to talk to all of you and talk more about this show. It is Tuesday at the Museum of Contemporary Art, part of the museum's In Progress Tuesday Night series. And you also have another thing coming up.
The Cigar Box Guitar Festival in Berwyn.
Are you guys part of that too? Okay, I don't want him leaving you guys. I don't want him dumping you anywhere. I want you all to be together on this. I got to tell you, it's good to see you again, man. It really is. It really is. You're one of the most interesting. Now you are, too. This is... You may not make a lot of money doing it, but or any money, I don't know. or any money, for that matter. Well, but it's... You're expressing yourselves in a way that is non, to my mind, commercial pandering. And I think that's great. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this is going to be a rare experience. Sid Yiddish and his musical pals are going to, when I give them the hand signal or whatever it is I'll give you, here is a live read. Ready? Early mornings. Stay safe and connected with Morgan Kolkmeyer's weather forecasts and Sarah Gindra's traffic reports. Weekdays, 4 to 6 on WGN TV Morning News.
Thank you.
I'll try to get you guys money for doing that. Sid, could you do me a favor and introduce each one of these people again? And if you guys want to say a little something, I don't know, hi to your mom or whatever it is. I mean, or if you could, in a second, give me your take on what it is to be part of this group. Now, I know that's asking a lot, but you feel like doing that?
Sure.
Go ahead. Come on over here. Grab a, or sit down there. Grab a mic.
Come sit on my lap, Bob.
Yeah, 13. Sit on Sid's lap.
Come sit on my lap, 13.
Or just hold the mic?
Yeah. You want to go first?
Sure.
Okay. Talk to me.
Hey.
Hey.
I'm Babs.
And you met him a couple years ago.
When yeah, I was just at a show, probably like Resistor, I think.
Yeah.
My awesome friend Ronnie has that place. And
yeah.
I used to do, like, video and stuff. He would just need someone to film it, and I would volunteer. And one day I just asked if I could join.
And she
What was it? Was it the improvisational nature of what he does? Is that what appealed to you?
Yeah, and just the whole scene, I think. It's just really different, and Chicago's really awesome for that. So, I don't know.
That's great.
Nothing I'd ever seen before. So.
Exactly. No, and I think... No, I'm serious.
Yeah,
that's
one of
the appeals of you, man. You're like, you're totally something I've never seen before. Thank you. I hope this is a success. You, sir?
Yes. I am... Oh, nice. That was very nice.
Improv.
I am June. I am a member... I'm a member of the Henchmen.
A proud member of the Henchmen?
Proud member of the Henchmen.
And how did you get involved?
Well, my son here, 13, going on 12, 12 going on 13, he told me one day, he said, hey, June, I know these people, these old men who play music and they never rehearse this music. They just simply don't rehearse it. Would you like to join? And without a moment's hesitation, I told him yes.
And has it been the rewarding experience you imagined it to be?
Yes, it absolutely has. It's actually been far more than rewarding, I must say.
It's been transforming.
And the privilege to be on your program and to be sent out on these wavelengths, on these airwaves, is just beyond words.
My program.
I paid him to say that.
Yes,
so,
yes, he did. I would like
the only payment you receive here is the magnificent views of the city of Chicago. Very nice.
Yes,
yeah,
and I'll,
nice.
I'll, since he has laryngitis, I'll tell you how he came to be. I met him actually at the ESS. Experimental Sound Studio garage sale about 3-4 years ago, and he was hawking his CD, and I said, hey, you want to play in my band? And he said, yeah, sure. And lo and behold,
that's all you have to say is you want to, no one says to you, who are you?
Nope.
Everybody no. knows you now.
Yeah, well, pretty much.
You making a living?
Yeah, I'm making somewhat of a living. I took a year off from acting and performing after my mother passed away.
Yeah, I was so sorry to hear that.
Yeah, yeah. And so I just, that was like last July when I stopped, but I'm slowly getting back into it, doing commercials and plays. And
one of the things, you don't have a website, do you?
No, we're working on that.
Well, I don't have a website either,
Facebook.
So I feel we're...
Yeah, but...
I can fully be a member of your group.
Oh, absolutely.
But you need that, though. I mean, the commercial considerations, though you are not sort of a commercial-centric outfit, you do need to sort of spread the word, right?
Right. Well, we do that, but, I mean, we do it through Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and a lot of the other... social media platforms that are out there. And plus, the band really talks it up when we do shows and they share things and stuff. I mean, and especially 13, when he can talk, you should hear him. That guy is just, you can't shut him up. Thank you.
Well, all of you who are going to the Museum of Contemporary Art this Tuesday night will be in for a real treat. Is there another member of this band?
Yeah, well, there's several other members.
How many?
Probably, let's see, 1, 2, 3.
At the most, it's about 12.
It's 8. No, it's 8.
Oh, really?
It's 8. We kind of pared it down a bit.
So 8 is the core.
Yeah, that's the core.
The core of the band.
Yeah, we lose them here and there. You know, they get jobs, they move up.
So what time? I do want to promote this show because I have seen you in a different kind of... characterization, but I've always admired you, and I really like you three, and I'm thinking, man, this would be fun. I think you people should go to Museum of Contemporary Art Tuesday night. What time?
Starts at 6, and it goes till 8. We do the performance, and then there's like a discussion afterwards about the piece and what we did right and what they think we didn't do right and what we could possibly have done right.
That's great. I only have a minute left of this show. Can you... Yes, of course. Wait a minute. If you guys can't, you know, sort of, as they say, play us out, I don't know who could. Do you need a signal from Sid?
Yeah, let's just let's do it on the old three here, okay?
Here it is, ladies and gentlemen. Sid Yiddish and some of his candy store henchmen.
Trois, quatre, cinq, six, sept, huit, neuf.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. It is good to see you. It's lovely to meet you three. I may try to get over there Tuesday night.
I'd love to see you there.
Museum of Contemporary Art. We'll be back. Welcome back. It was a manic segment with Sid and the kids. He's a fascinating, fascinating talent. It is my pleasure, I think we have her on the phone. Rita, are you on the phone?
Yes, I am.
Hi.
I hope it's your pleasure.
It was mine. Well, I don't know, Rita. I must tell you, it's not always the case where if I adore a book, as I did your first novel, The 14th of September, that does not necessarily mean that I will adore the interview, but you sound very nice, and you are obviously a terribly talented writer. After a life as a public relations executive, it seems to me, from reading some of your biographical information, that you have always wanted to be a creative writer. Is that true, or am I making too much of that?
Oh, no, that's absolutely true. From way back when, I mean, I didn't write short stories as an infant or anything like many of the, like Victor Hugo or anyone like that.
Right.
But I have to say that I had a very creative imagination. I used to call it daydreaming, and I would read a lot, and then I would write myself parts into books.
Oh, how interesting.
Yeah, so like, for example, the Thomas Castain Plantagenet novel,
mm-hmm.
all now have a little girl that has a blue or purple veil with one of those little crowns, you know.
And charming.
I did that for Egypt, I did it for all kinds of things, and then didn't actually start writing them down until closer to junior high.
One of the things, though, obviously you're not, you wrote in junior high, then you probably wrote in high school, and you might have written in college, too, but then you took a different course. You did not start to devote yourself, maybe it's because you didn't discover Ragdale until later in life, but you got into a different kind of form of writing. I've known a number of people in the public relations industry for many, many years, and there's a lot of writing that takes place in public relations. It is so vastly different than creative writing. Not that it's not creative. I am not saying that at all, because it is, in its fashion, terribly creative, but it's so vastly different from the unencumbered way in which you can go about writing a novel. Do I sound like an idiot, Rita, or not?
No, we're on the same wavelength.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
I have to say that despite the fact that I always wanted to write creatively, I also had a mother who was very clear on the fact that I was going to have to make a living and eat while I was doing it.
Yes.
And I had no illusions about the fact that even though I considered writing my avocation, you know, that ultimately I would get to that.
Sure.
PR, as you know, is a writing career.
No question.
You get into it. What I did is, particularly when I got to a very major PR agency, I found what it was like to be creative in community. So brainstorming, coming up with ideas, coming mm-hmm. up with, didn't have to be an entire story. It could be campaign. And that was very satisfying for a while. And then ironically, I found out that I was really good at the business side, you know, this thing called strategy. I had
sure.
no idea what it was. And so the higher you go, the less you write.
True.
And so, but, you know, again, it's busy and writing takes a tremendous amount of time. So it was always on the back burner. And then about, 15 years ago, I had been at major agencies. I sold my agency and then I decided, okay, this is when I'm going to write this story that I had in my mind. It was queued up for all these years. And I started another business, a consulting business, and they were both going to be part-time. Don't
oh, sure
ever
they were,
start
yeah.
a business and a book at the same time.
I can only imagine.
Because that's where Ragdale came in. I wrote most of my book at Ragdale.
We're talking about Ragdale, the sort of writer's colony in Lake Forest that has been a salvation for all manner of writers. To give them peace and quiet and also the chance to talk to other writers in a lovely, lovely setting. Rita Dragonet is the author of what I must say is a fantastic novel. It is hard to believe that this is your first novel. It was hard for our mutual friend Patricia Ann McNair to believe that, and Patrick Reardon, my former colleague at the Chicago Tribune. There was a ton of advance praise for this book. Was there, though, Rita Dragonet? I'm curious. I want to read a little something from the book after we have tried to describe what it's about, because I love your writing. Was there a sense of urgency to this next career in your life? You know what I mean? I mean,
right. Well, what I did was I feel like I spent about 3/4 of my life either experiencing the activities that were in the book, thinking about
yeah,
it,
yeah.
writing it, and marketing it. But there was an urgency after I sold my agency when I actually got into it. I started taking classes at the Graham School. I started to get involved in Ragdale. I took everything I had learned in PR because I knew that I couldn't spend as long
right.
becoming a good writer as I had becoming a good PR person, or I wouldn't live that long.
Sure.
I mean, I'd be Michelangelo. I'd be, you know, 225 years old, and maybe I'd be in my second novel. As you said, Ragdale taught me process. University of Chicago got me into workshops. It just allowed me to deal with experts and not waste time.
Yeah, good. That's a great.
But I had to teach myself how to write creatively because I hadn't had training in it. I'd taken creative writing classes in college, but when I was in college, they weren't as sophisticated as they are now. You
sure.
just bring something into workshop and people would tear it apart. And if you survived, you know.
Exactly. If you survived, you walked out and said, I'm never doing that again.
Exactly. Certainly never talking to those people again.
Yes, yeah. I never want to see those people. Oh, boy, have I heard those stories. Patricia Ann McNair, who is one of this area's most talented writers, had
She's
this
wonderful.
To say, and a nice person, too, had this to say about the 14th of September. Quote, this debut novel deftly captures a generation on the cusp of an uncertain future. The characters' choices are difficult, their solutions complex. At times charming and funny, at others intense and heartbreaking, Dragonet depicts a complicated chapter in our history with precision and depth and renders it with compassion, understanding, and grace. One of the things I love about your book is the title of your book, because I, being part of the, I don't want to keep people in suspense about what it is. There was a lottery for those of you of a certain age on December 1st in 1969, on which numbered, I think they were blue-colored balls.
They were blue.
Yeah, and at least I'm not senile yet. Thank you, Rita. They were picked with dates of the year, and it was in the order in which young men in this country would be drafted. September 14th was number one.
Yes.
I was lucky enough to be born in 1952, so July of 1970 when that. Those numbers were picked. My number was 238, corresponding to September 13th. What so intrigued me about this, about your novel, The Rita Dragonette, is that it stars, for lack of a better word, a woman, interesting, complicated, fascinating, forthright, but also burdened kind of woman. I'm fascinated with Judy Talton's mom too, even though she is not a huge character in the book.
She looms.
She sure does. when you first meet her in that early flashback to, you know, sort of what. What was expected of women going to college in those days? What small career paths were open to them? How much? And no, this is a stupid question. How much of Rita is you?
Well, you know, that is the first question that everyone asks. So it's not stupid. It's natural curiosity, and I would say that the structure of Judy's dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
Is something that is similar to what I went through. But I never intended it to be closely autobiographical. As a matter of fact, I had a writing teacher at University of Chicago, and I went to him one day and I said, I need a dilemma for Judy that's every bit as has the gravitas of something I went through. What can I possibly do? And he looked at me like I had two heads, and he said, you're a writer. This is your material. Use it. So that gave me permission.
Permission, sure.
But I lived through those times, and that is why I felt like it was so important to write it from a woman's point of view.
Yeah.
If you think about it, there are very, very few books from a female point of view in Vietnam, if you can think of any.
Oh, I can't.
I don't want to say it absolute.
No, but I have read, and this is so my era too, and I cannot think of any, and that's what just kept me glued to the pages. I want to take a little break and come back and read just a couple paragraphs chosen almost at random from Rita Dragonette's book, and then we'll talk a little more about the arduous nature of marketing one's own work in this idiotic, strange publishing age. We will be right back. I'll tell you, the Steve Cochran Show has free Blackhawk tickets for you tomorrow morning at 7:50, so be listening. We'll be right back. The protagonist of Rita Dragonette's first novel, first of what I hope will be a series of novels, is titled The 14th of September, is named Judy Talton, and she is, in a sense, caught between two words. Rita, can I read a paragraph or two? Would you mind?
Absolutely.
And this is just a random paragraph.
Curious
because
music's
a big, big part of this book. But this is really kind of at random because I am a child of this time, too, and I was just taken with, here. Her new life was exciting, but it took up most of her time. She certainly couldn't risk her grades or she would lose her scholarship. When she wasn't with her new friends until 3 in the morning when the tune room closed, she was invited night after night as they assembled in one dorm room or another, supposedly to study, but they always ended up just lying around on the bunks or on the floor listening to music. The guys, other than Will, would dig deep into the albums, not the lyrics, which she thought was the best part, but the riffs. They would imitate Eric Clapton or Led Zeppelin's Robert Plant by seeing how fast they could play their imaginary guitars, often down the spine of whatever girl was lying next to them. Judy tried to get as interested in the music as they were, but to do that, she needed to be high. And she couldn't keep up both sides of her life if she was wasted every night. She started to smoke cigarettes so it wouldn't be so obvious that she was passing on most of the joints going around. Then, quote, "It's more important to experience life, not books," Achilles would say of an evening. "To hear this effing incredible music, I mean, come together. What else needs to be said? That's what's real, man. There can be no war if we think like that." That's so captured an era for me. I know that guy. I know that yourself, scene. And it's just, it's really, really, really good writing. You sound incredibly smart and sensitive, Rita Dragonette. There must be an incredibly empowering feeling having this book between covers, because this book was between the synapses of your brain for decades, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, 3/4 of my life. Yeah. I weighed that out. Yeah. It was something that was not only what I wanted to talk about, but it was something that I really felt like I had to.
Yeah.
Because having gone through that time, as you did, we're contemporaries.
Yep.
I did feel, and I think you can remember the day, is that the women, particularly on the campus, which is where the majority of draft-age men were.
Sure.
The women were right with the men.
Yep.
We called them guys. The girls and the guys were together, but the women didn't always have the standing or the stature. And
no, you were very much, very much, very much a part. I remember hauntingly the young woman on her knees screaming in the air, obviously the most famous photo from the Kent State.
Right.
Yeah, but that was it. I mean, otherwise it was a sort of male-centric kind of scene. Ooh, I got this draft number. Ooh, I got this draft number. And women were... It was an incredible time for women, I think, and I don't want to get into the whole feminism.
Well, it was early feminism.
Yeah, there's
that scene on lottery night that really just tells what it was like to be every bit as worried, but not even be able to be in the room.
Yeah, yeah, and not really be able to express that worry and express
right.
that thing. I can't tell you. You also have a very well. It's an old. As an old PR pro, you have a very, very, very nice website, Rita Dragonette, RitaDragonette.com, and you have a lot of events coming up, some private, some not. How's the marketing? I've never talked to a successful public relations executive who has written an extraordinarily good novel to ask, how's the marketing aspect of this for you? Enjoyable or no?
Well, you know, I thought it would be more fun.
Yeah, I bet.
It isn't quite... It's very intense. In the beginning, it was a lot more arduous than it is. Now I'm having a great deal of fun with it. But it is an amazing thing, Rick, because what you're doing is you spend most of your time in PR telling clients or advising clients on what they should be doing. And they usually accept somewhere between 60 and 75% of what you say.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're doing your own marketing... You do 100% of what you think is the right thing to do. And you also know how to do, I think where it's a little different is most writers don't like marketing.
Yeah.
They think it's, you know,
yeah.
that it's uncomfortable for them. And I have been waiting all these years to be able to come out and talk about this book.
Yeah, I'll bet.
And I understand what a campaign is, you know, so it's you can't just do one thing or two things. You have to do many, many, many layers of things. And particularly in this social media environment, it's just...
driving me crazy, frankly.
Well, you know.
I know, but it's necessary. Yeah, it's not so much a necessary evil. It really is a necessary chore.
It's a phenomenal way to actually market a book, and it's so much easier than it used to be.
Yeah.
But by the same token, traditional media, you know, has shrunk so much.
Look at the books. You know, of course. I mean, there are no books. As far as I know, there are very few programs that on TV and or radio that are devoted to books. Book sections of major newspapers have shrunk and disappeared. It's tough. It's tough out there. You are talking about doing one or two or three or many things at once. You're currently, I love this line on your website. She is currently working on three additional books. I love that line. And one is a sort of homage to one of my favorite novels, even though he was a sexist kind of goof. He could still write. The Sun Also Rises, a World War II novel based upon your interest in that, and a memoir and essays. I'm interested in all of them, of course, Rita Dragonette. I'm particularly interested in the memoir.
Oh, the memoir and essay?
Yeah.
Well, it is a, and actually, you know who inspired me to think about that was Patricia McNair.
Oh, how nice.
But the memoir, the title, essay in the memoir and the title of the book itself is going to be called, and here's another thing, it'll go back to our shared childhood, Violating the Prime Directive. So remember your Star Trek?
Oh, yes.
I just always thought that was just such a beautiful phrase. So that particular essay is about being childless, so you can see how appropriate that is.
Yeah.
But rather than a memoir cover to cover, furniture moving every single step, it's like, what is these episodic epiphanies that are universal in things that I have gone through that I am working on in between these other two.
Sure.
And the reason there are so many things keyed up, I know it sounds like, oh, come on.
I like it. Stop that.
But I have been, you know, being the perfectionist PR person that I always was, I was like, I have to finish 14th of September before I can work on anything else.
Good for you.
And that, decades doing it. And sometimes it was like homework.
Yeah, I bet. Sure.
And
sure.
This time I want to be able to go back and forth. I mean, Also Rises one is actually a contemporary novel.
Oh, I think that's... Well, I will be the first in line at whatever bookstore you are signing those. Rita Dragonette, it is a pleasure to meet you over the telephone. It is a real, distinct, and memorable pleasure to have read the 14th of September. Thank you.
Well, I'm thrilled, and I hope I was as adorable live as I was on the pages.
More so. More so. Thank you, dear. Happy holidays and all that jazz. Keep writing. Don't let the holidays get in the way of your writing. It was a real pleasure. The 14th of September is a great novel. Thanks for listening to this eclectic gathering of people. I will see you next week.